Are you ready, Alabama?
Hello? Who's there? What's going on?
You're listening to our number two in the doghouse.
Whatever's happening here, just knock it off.
Call the big dog now at 866-485-9867.
These kids are weird, man. They're weird.
Live from the Big Dog Production Studios.
How you doing?
It's the Tom Abraham Show.
That might be listed in Revelations as the cause for the apocalypse.
Here he is, the head of the household, the Big Dog.
You're the smartest guy I've ever met.
Tom Abraham.
You want me to do this crap?
I guess I'm on here. Am I on? Can somebody respond?
Now, welcome back, Tom Abraham Show, hour number two on a reaction Monday in the doghouse. And, of course, there's so much to react to. It'll take us a couple of days to get through it all. I mean, we could spend 2 days just talking about the scrimmages that took place in Tuscaloosa and Auburn, and we will spend a little bit more time on that. For those of you that missed it, by the way, Jared Stidham named the starting quarterback at Auburn, and that's pretty much the way everybody thought that would go. You know, around East parts, it's all about Alabama and Auburn, and New York City, you know, the next 3 or 4 days, it'll be the Mets and the Yankees, a little subway rivalry. Joining us from the city, from CBS Sports Radio, Damon Amendolara. DA, welcome in. How are you?
I'm doing good, Big Dog. Man, I've actually wanted to talk to you the last couple of days after Dick McPherson passed away last week. He was a classic Syracuse coach, obviously helped lead them back into relevance and success. And with your roots up there, I kind of wanted to hear your thoughts on the passing of Mac and his legacy.
Well, just such so much a first-class guy, and what he meant so much. I was a young high school coach at the time when I first met him and got to see him at clinics and stuff, and he was so first class, and he meant so much to the high school coaches in the state of New York, because it's so much different up there than it is, you know, in the dirty South. And we're also talking about 30 years ago, but he meant so much to so many. And what I loved about Coach Mack was he taught the regalness of coaching. You know, he taught about what an honor it was to be a teacher of young men and things like that. And he shaped a lot of other coaches that came after him. You know, he did not get enough credit for being a coach, an X's and O's coach, and what he did with Syracuse, putting him back on the map. But the biggest thing that I'll take from Coach Mack, first class guy that taught us it was an honor and a privilege to be a coach.
It's pretty cool, man. That's not something that you hear a lot about former coaches. And I wonder how different maybe his legacy is if he ended up not taking that Patriots job. You know, he had turned the corner with Syracuse. They were a real contender year in, year out. Once that 87 season hit, 87, 88, 89. Then he leaves in 90 for the Patriots job, which is just destined to fail, obviously, because obviously that's a team that was not investing a lot of money into its resources, into its facilities, pre-Robert Kraft. And they were just a disaster. I wonder if he stayed there and had a good 20-year run or so, if we don't remember him as maybe a larger presence in the college football history.
You know, maybe. I don't know that he hadn't maximized what you could do at Syracuse, you know, because of the limitations that you have there in a 50,000-seat, you know, arena and being in Syracuse, New York, and things like that. But I tell you what, just a first-class guy. He impacted so many coaches in the Northeast. It was just incredible. And Paul Pasqualoni was really a good guy, too. I mean, he kind of kept that thing going in terms of being an honorable guy, a guy that didn't get the program in trouble, things like that. He just wasn't the coach that Coach Mack was.
Yeah, and, for people that look at Syracuse football now, they just assume that it's always been a horrible job and impossible to do and last place here and there. But really, under Coach Mack's last 5 years, and then Paul Pasqualoni's first 5 years, they were top 25. They were top 10. They were going to Orange Bowls and Fiesta Bowls and big-time bowl games. They beat number one Nebraska at the Carrier Dome in 1984. They were undefeated up until the Sugar Bowl in 87. I mean, it was an amazing run, and it seems like it's so millions of miles away, and all of that has to do with Coach Mack turning it around.
Well, in these parts, you know, they still talk about tie-dye when Pat Dye went for the tie. in the Sugar Bowl against Syracuse. And you know, a lot
they
of
still
people
talk about it in Central New York, too.
I would imagine that they do. And, you know, Damon Amendola with us. So Yankees-Mets coming off of Yankees-Red Sox. You wonder about that. You know, what a wonderful series that was. I mean, that, to me, is what baseball is about. That just, it looks, I know you're a Mets guy, but I'm just saying, Yankees-Red Sox battling it out for first place in the AL East. They're going to be doing this now for years to come. It looks like the way these two teams are set up, it looks right. It's sports eye candy. The atmosphere in that building at Yankee Stadium was absolutely tremendous. If you were going to put it in a time capsule and show somebody this is what baseball can be, minus the 3.5 hour game, you know, I think that's what we saw this weekend was fantastic.
Yep. Still, when you have those two teams and they're good, it's compelling theater. And no matter what, Yankees and Red Sox playing against one another is going to be one of those events that does cross the boundaries of even kind of non-hardcore baseball fans. So I'm with you. It was a real fun series over the weekend. I think, though, you did see, and over the last couple of weeks, that the Red Sox are just they're just farther ahead in their development, and they've got right now a better team than the Yankees do, and that's why I always thought it was a little bit of fool's gold for Yankee fans to want to see Brian Cashman make big deals at the trade deadline and kind of go for something this year. I always felt like this was kind of a bonus year for the Yankees. They weren't supposed to be a playoff team. They were supposed to be a 500 team, and you know, sacrificing anything in the future for this year, I always thought was kind of silly. We didn't sell off too much, obviously, to make some deals. And Sonny Gray, you do have under control for a couple of seasons. But the Red Sox right now they're just a step above what the Yankees are, because the Yankees are just a little bit more young and inexperienced.
Yeah, well, Chris Sale is just freaky good, and David Price, when he's healthy and you don't have him in the playoffs, you know, very good. They're very good on the mound. There's no question about it. But you know, one of the things that drives me nuts, I wanted to get your take on it. The Friday night game. I don't understand. It's a 3-0 game. It's the eighth inning. Red Sox are sailing along. They had taken out a pitcher that had given up, like, you know, three hits and no runs in the game. That's okay. That's fine. But in the eighth inning, the absolute core, the meat of the Yankee lineup is coming up. Why don't they run Huntsville, Alabama's Chris Kimbrell? Craig Kimbrell? Why don't they run Craig Kimbrell out then? Why are these teams so hell-bent on this is when our closers got to close? That game was on the line in the eighth inning. They end up giving up five runs and blow the opportunity to really what would have ended up being a sweep in that series.
The inflexibility of how baseball managers have now groomed their bullpens is really a pathetic thing. It's really a sorry existence, because these guys should be ready to go in the most high leverage, high pressure situations based on how effective they are. And the fact that we now have a generation of closers that are only comfortable if they come in with a clean sheet and a 3-run lead or less in a save situation in the top of the ninth or the bottom of the ninth, is so ridiculous and so silly. And as you said, I mean, this is just because we've kind of conditioned all of these closers that you only have one role, and that's the only thing we can ask of you. So you either are the setup guy in the eighth, but you have to come in a clean save situation or a clean situation with nobody on, start the inning. Ninth, you're closer, you know the situation. Only in save opportunities do we even use you. Before that, we have the third best reliever that will try to get us out of a jam in the seventh inning. I mean, it's sad. It really is sad that they have not conditioned these guys to be ready for any situation that they get thrown into.
Yeah, and I'm not saying you got to go in for, you know, the old Goose Gossage 3-inning save or something like that. I'm just saying, why not run the guy out there for the eighth when you know you're going against the meat of the lineup, shut them down, and then you could run Joe Kelly or some other reliever against the bottom third of the lineup. It's just, those are the kind of things that makes me nuts with baseball. And Joe Girardi does it all the time. I mean, he does it all. He pulled Luis Severino out of that game after six innings because. And they're just going to do that, and it's crazy. But you know, that's part of baseball I don't understand. By the way, do you think that now that Derek Jeter has bought the Marlins. There's so many interesting things there, ties between the Yankees and the Marlins. And, of course, Donnie Baseball is the manager there. You wonder about A-Rod, you know, being a Miami guy and Jeets and what could happen down the road. But most importantly, do you think that Derek Jeter will get the Marlins back in pinstripes and put them back in that gear that they were wearing when they were the Florida Marlins and not that clown outfit that they wear now?
Yeah, this new uniform that they have is awful.
Terrible.
It's just so stupid. It's just so dumb. I really did like the one that they won in 2003 with that were black, the pinstripes, a little teal, a little silver. I wasn't a big fan of the 97 ones. I didn't like the vests with the teal under them, with the teal T-shirts. But I wonder how much influence Jeter's even going to have. You know, sometimes when you have these franchises that are bought and then you have a superstar celebrity or an athlete at the front of it, that's all they really are. It's just a front. Like, Jay-Z never owned the Nets. Jay-Z owned, like, less than 1% of the Nets. They just propped him up on the sideline, courtside, every single game to make it seem like, you know, he was kind of the celebrity face of the franchise. So I need to see what percentage Jeter actually has as part of this investment.
I my understanding is a pretty big chunk of it, and he is – what I thought I read was that he was going to be the head of baseball operations, that he was going to be the guy that was making – now, I don't know, you know, what's Magic Johnson do with the Dodgers? I'm not sure, you know, other than have the big pocketbook there. But I thought that Jeter was actually going to have a day-to-day responsibility in running that operation.
That'd be interesting. I'd like to see if that's actually the case because – you know, then you're actually talking about some real fingerprints and you're actually in on the day-to-day basis and whatnot, because, you know, there's a lot of these guys that put their money down, plunk their money down or whatever, but just kind of want to be seen and, you know, be around the team every so often and kind of float in, float out, but don't really have a vested interest on the daily operations. So I'd love to see it if Jeter does have that.
Before I get off the baseball gear, by the way, I don't understand how Major League Baseball, it's one thing to have, you know, half the teams wearing their pants up, the other half team wears their pants down. We know it wasn't this way up until about 10 or 12 years ago. Guys, it was a way that you wore a baseball uniform. But now you've got guys that are wearing socks. And I was watching a game the other day. It was the Oakland A's. And they had three different kind of socks on. That one guy had socks that said A on it. Another guy just had solid green socks, and another guy had socks with stripes on it. I'm like, how can baseball allow this? That the uniform is not even uniform. It's like, wear whatever socks you want. It's nuts. I know they're doing this thing this weekend, you know, with the goofy nicknames and everything else. Okay, fine, we'll stomach that crap. But in a regular, you know, night-to-night games, you see guys on the same team wearing different socks in their uniforms.
Yeah, it's amazing they don't make that uniform. It's amazing they don't make that standard, considering like how crazy the NFL is about that. Oh. You're not allowed to have one sock or one shoulder or one anything out of place or unique, and yet here's baseball maybe going the other way. I mean, is baseball doing this specifically to combat this idea the NFL is too much of a uniform police? I don't know.
I don't know, but the NFL, I mean, look what were the Rams wearing the other day? The Rams, my son came into the room, he sat down. The Rams, of course, got the new white helm, the white horns, are going to the Roman Gabriel, look at his 60s. They got the white pants with the one thick stripe down the side, Roman Gabriel, 1960s. And then they have their jersey on that they've been wearing currently for the last 5 or 6 years. My son walked in the room, he sat down and he said, did their jerseys not come in time? Why are they wearing two different uniforms? It looks so stupid. But
yeah.
But the league has this rule where you got to have a 2-year window before you can change the jersey. You could change your helmet, you could change your pants, but you can't change your jersey. So they got this jersey on with a miscolored blue. They got gold trim on it. You know, why not just wait till next year and just go to a full new uniform next year when you move into your new building? They rush into the white helmets, and then they've got the – they got the old jersey. It looks so mismatched. It looks ridiculous.
Yeah, I don't understand that either. And also this helmet rule is now really stupid when it comes to – they're saying it's all about safety, that you're not allowed to have different color helmets, base color helmets, because they want one size or one helmet for the entire year to help out concussions, to be more safe about it. But, I mean, like – Sammy Watkins gets traded to the Rams. He doesn't bring his Bills helmet.
Right.
Like, they got to suit him up for another one. And so, what, it's when guys get traded midseason, they can definitely start with a new helmet. But if you are on the team already, you can't start with a new helmet. And that takes us out of the running of all these really cool classic throwback helmets and uniforms that we should be able to have. So something doesn't add up there. I never trust the NFL when it comes to that stuff.
Well, plus, most guys don't wear the same helmet for practice that they do for games. So they're wearing two different helmets anyway. I mean, that's just a goofy thing. And then we got to see the Lions' that debuted. And I got to tell you, again, it's so often you try to do things, you try to tweak things, but it ain't the Barry Sanders gear. It's not the Honolulu blue look with the white trim on the number. I couldn't even see the numbers. Those gray numbers on those blue jerseys, and it's just, it's better. I guess maybe it's better than what they had, but it's just not. It feels like they missed on that uniform.
It's like, why can't they just accept that if they go back to the originals, it's going to be the best one? And you're going to be lauded for it. Everyone's going to love going back because there's all that nostalgia around them. The way that the uniform thing happens now within the NFL and other circles, specifically the NFL, is mind blowing to me. I will say that I had lost all faith in Nike because of how much they botched all the NFL uniforms, but their rolling out of this year's NBA jerseys actually, I think, have largely been pretty slick. So it's restoring some faith. But gosh, in the NFL, boy, have they just taken a torch and lit on fire so many great uniforms Nike has.
Yeah, no, they have. But in college, like the new Penn State, Penn State's going to be wearing a kind of a throwback look. And some of the other teams that have got new gear out, they've kind of gotten more conservative. They went away from the crazy stuff. So, Nike's done a good job with the college gear.
Yeah, it's like they realize in college you want to go tradition, old school, simplified, streamlined it. And then the NFL, it's like, oh, let's get crazier, let's get wilder. And it's like, why wouldn't you use the same idea for both unless the NFL is telling them we want to get younger, we want to get kids involved? I don't know. But what Nike has done to the NFL has basically, whatever they've touched has turned to absolute dog crap.
Do you think that in honor of Dick McPherson, maybe Syracuse can get back into something that we recognize as a Syracuse uniform? Or maybe go back to the Donovan McNabb, Marvin Harrison gear or something like that?
But how great would that be?
That'd
if they
be cool.
Just at least had like one big traditional game, maybe against, whether it's the Florida State game that they play or if they play Virginia Tech or if they play Clemson, and get into like the Marvin Graves uniform. Let's do the 1987 a 30-year throwback uniforms. How awesome would those uniforms be? I mean, they are wedded to these stupid Nike ones that are just hideous, basically. But at least give us one where there's a throwback in there for the 30th anniversary of 87.
Yeah. Damon Amendola with the CBS Sports Radio. All right, before I let you go, speaking of football, Jim Irsay got loose again. Talking about the quarterback position with the Colts, according to Greg Doyle from the Indianapolis Star, used to be with CBS.com, CBS Sports Radio, or CBSSports.com. Anyway, he was asked if they had considered bringing in any other quarterbacks. He said, we did have a quarterback candidate or two. I think that we came semi-close to bringing in a mid-30 to mid-late 30 guy. Sounds like Jay Cutler, maybe. The guy wanted more money than we wanted to give him. He was asked if he's seen his quarterback throw yet, Andrew Luck. He says, I have, and I haven't. He also said about playing week one, he could play against the Rams, but he could not. I'm confident he'll be ready at the start of the season, but that may not be the Ram game, but the start of the season. I'm telling you, man, somebody's got to make Jim Irsay piss in a bottle again. I think the guy's losing it.
He's totally losing it. I mean, yeah, he says, Andrew Luck is going to be ready for the start of the season, but maybe not the Rams game, which is the season opener. So just to clarify, Andrew Luck will be ready for the start of the season, but maybe not the first game of the start of the season. Like, what? Well, when else is the start of the season, Jim? When is that? Following Jim Irsay's logic is like always a losing proposition. The guy has been on a lot of pain meds for a really long time. Very obviously, he is losing it. And so we need to get him to step away from the microphone. It's like Jerry Jones.
Yeah.
Like, just don't talk about Ezekiel Elliott. How about that?
Yeah.
Why don't we just try that instead of saying stuff that you will obviously regret and make you look stupid?
He was asked if he trusts his coaching staff to handle things if Luck misses extended time. His answer was, if it's two games, hypothetically. What the hell is that? I don't even know what that means. I mean, that's like Ron Zook when he was at Florida. What the Zook did he say? Right? I mean, I don't even know what he said.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, basically, yes. He's like Ron Zook plus 30 years.
Yeah.
Take the microphone away from Jim Irsay and Jerry Jones.
Yeah. By the way, stunning number. You mentioned Zeke Elliott. Stunning number ESPN put out this morning. The Cowboys have lost 104 games due to suspension in the last 2.5 years, since 2014.
Oh, my gosh.
That's, check this out. That's 39 more games than any other team in the NFL during that span. I mean, that's amazing.
Wow. That is a mind-blowing number. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's good that they gave Stephen Jones a lot more of the control now, but you just always still wonder how much of the envelope is getting pushed constantly by Jerry Jones to win now.
Yeah, well, that's it'll go down by a game or two. I think Zeke will get it busted down to, you know, the Roethlisberger deal. He'll probably get it busted down to 4. But, man, just crazy there in Dallas. And it's been that way during Jerry Jones' entire ownership, going all the way back to the White House days, back when Michael Irvin and that crew were there. So, all right, man, appreciate you. It's always great stuff. Now, are you going to the Mets-Yankees games that will be in Citi Field where you're a season ticket holder?
I got a little double dip. Tomorrow night, I'm going to be at Yankee Stadium, and then on Thursday night, I'm going to be at Citi Field, so I'll get to see both sides of the Subway Series.
Wow. All right. That's good stuff. And I know you're a big college football fan, and I just want to tell you, my credentials just came in for Florida State, Alabama on September 2nd. So, you know, if you want to make a little weekend trip to Atlanta, I got a room. All right. I got just give
Ooh,
me a
okay.
holler. Let me know. I got a place for you to crash.
I appreciate that very much. Yeah, I'm going over the schedule as we speak because we got the Sunday morning football deal, so I got to work that into the mix. But, man, my college football juices are flowing. I cannot wait for Labor Day weekend.
Well, first college football game in the Mercedes-Benz Stadium, too. And I'm geeked about that because I was in the last college football game in the old stadium and now the first college football game in the new stadium. That'll be something to, you know, that's something cool to have.
It's going to be awesome, man. I can't wait.
All right, man. Appreciate you as always.
Okay.
All right. See
you. You got it, dog. Right, see you, man. Okay.
Damon Amendola. Always solid work right there. All right. Let's get a break. We'll come back with more right after this. It's the Tom Abraham Show, 730-1039. The Hump.
Now back to the big dog. This show is rough.
I remember waiting for the school bus. Jenny Clayton was my first crush, and neither one of us had a clue. In Cheyenne, it was my first truck.
Rusted back in 2007, I was in the press box at the Alabama-Tennessee game, and word had come down. I had actually gotten a text from my son, who was at that time on the staff, and he had sent me a text from the box saying that, or from the locker room, saying that there was going to be a problem and they were going to have 5 players suspended. And it turned out to be a deal where players who got books on their with their scholarship money were turning the books in, returning them at the bookstore for cash. It sounds to me a little bit similar to what was going on at Florida, the situation that Antonio Callaway has got himself caught up in now. And joining us to talk about it, Mark Long from the AP there in North Florida. Mark, welcome in. How are you?
Hey, doing good, Tom. How are you?
I am fantastic. All right, so first of all, tell us, you know, give us the details of exactly what we know as to what these players were doing to lead to the suspension.
Yeah, well, it sounds similar to what you're talking about. It's basically they went in with their student ID card that's tied to money that's provided through their scholarship. And they went in and bought some stuff, some electronics on this card. And then the card didn't have the money to cover the electronics. And then they reported the card stolen. So it's a lot of this and that, of a little bit of fraud, a little bit of misrepresentation, a little bit of deceit, all those things tied into one. And the bottom line is just plain stupidity.
Yeah.
That these guys are dumb enough to think that they can get away with it and no one will notice, and that somebody would turn around and give them a new card without checking to see, you know, who took it and who used it and this and that. So I think more than anything, I mean, the whole thing is a big red flag. Antonio Callaway, the latest one for this kid. But more than anything, man, you got to wonder, how dumb is this kid?
Yeah. Well, and the thing is, there have been people that have called for, you know, some in the media calling for Jim McElwain just to pull the trigger on this guy. As gifted as he is as a player, I mean, he's had multiple problems. You know, he's coming off of a marijuana possession deal that he pleaded no contest to. He had a couple of Title IX investigations. I think at one point in time he lost his eligibility. You know, a couple of years ago, I remember when I was on here in Florida, I remember talking to you about this kid all the time. What do you think? Is that too severe? I mean, could there be a point where Jim McElwain says, that's it, enough is enough?
Well, I think the outsiders, me included, looked at it, so this guy's more trouble than he's worth. Because he's not, like, listen, he's not A.J. Green. He's a good little player, there's no doubt. He's a really good player on Florida's roster. But I don't know that he's all world. I'm not drafting the kid in the top 10. I'm not making him the first receiver taken in the NFL draft. So, you know, he's talented. I just don't know if he's talented enough to overlook the trouble. But from the McElwain standpoint, he can defend the kid because you look at him and you go, okay, he's had a marijuana citation, but he didn't test positive. So under NCAA rules, school rules, he hasn't tested positive for marijuana that we know of. And then you look at the Title IX investigation, well, he was cleared in that. So if you're Jim McElwain, it's real easy to look the other way because, you know, some of the stuff isn't necessarily, you know, hard and fast breaking of the rules.
Yeah, and also going to be missing this game, junior defensive end, Kevonis Davis, who is quality depth, I would think, right? A guy that, you know, he played in all 14 games last year. And, you know, that's a guy that probably was going to be relied upon to do something in this game, to be a contributor on some level, right?
Yeah, no doubt. He's the second biggest loss for them because he was going to be a rotational guy at 27 tackles, I think, last year and maybe a sack and a half. So a rotational guy on a pretty good defensive line last year. And was looking to take the step and play, you know, was going to get significantly more rep snaps this year. So that's going to hurt them, no doubt. But it's not, you know, not the huge loss that Callaway is. He's, again, their top playmaker.
Mark Long with us from the AP in North Florida. Now also caught up in it, a sophomore defensive lineman, Richard Desir Jones, and then some freshmen, both redshirt and true freshmen, that were not expected to contribute anything this year. But are these guys, are these all kind of like first flags for these guys?
Most of them, this is their first offense, their first flag. A lot of these guys knew each other for a few years. A lot of them are from the South Florida area, including Callaway from Fort Lauderdale, Broward, Miami-Dade, Miami area. So, you know, some of these kids knew each other. I think what we're going to do is we're going to find out at some point, you know, kids tend to turn on each other. Maybe that doesn't happen here. But I think we might find out who the ringleader was. Who's the guy who came up with the grand scheme here to, you know, defraud the university? And maybe that guy gets more punishment than the others. I've been told that they are not by any means out of the woods here with this suspension. I mean, there is a thought that this could be it, and they could be free and clear, assuming everybody repays everything. But, you know, who knows? The university is handling this thing, and nobody's really sure whether there might end up being criminal charges.
Yeah, and for Antonio Callaway, by now, I mean, this is supposed to be a team leader, you know, not a guy getting caught up with a bunch of young guys, you know, defrauding using their scholarship card where they put the money on it, and they can go ahead and coming up with this kind of a scheme. Now, some people will say, and I've said it, this is the kind of stuff that happens because these guys don't even have meal money for the most part. They don't have walking around money. They don't have pocket money. And this is the kind of thing that would be stopped if there were some sort of a true stipend and so on. But am I giving them too much of the benefit of the doubt here that this is doesn't matter? This is just guys doing bad stuff.
You're giving them way too much credit, way too much of the benefit of doubt. And they get a stipend nowadays. They're getting money. They get scholarship money. I mean, there's reports out there of guys who, you know, guys in college who are making money playing college football nowadays, making good money playing college football these days because of the grants and the stipends and all that money coming in. If they're spending it wisely, this is guys who had been told of a loophole, got greedy, and tried to abuse the system and tried to take advantage of the system. That's clearly what this is. And again, it goes back to Callaway has proven over 3 years that he can't make decisions. He makes bad ones. And, you know, he's not smart, probably not a good kid, probably more a thug than he is anything else. And, you know, I get why people say he ought to lose his privilege of playing college football. I get it. They're probably not too far off. I don't know how many second and third chances this kid's going to get, but I'll guarantee you this, if he wasn't talented, he wouldn't still be on this football team.
Well, and that brings me to an issue that drives a lot of SEC fans mad. In these parts, of course, Deshaun Hand, he had gotten arrested for a DUI. It turns out he was not driving a vehicle. He was sitting in a vehicle, sleeping in a vehicle in a parking lot, and had never driven the vehicle and so on. But it's Alabama law where, you know, if the keys are in the car, you're considered in control of the car and so on and so forth. He ends up getting some internal discipline that Nick Saban says that they'll do, and he will not miss any play time. The flip side of it is kid's never been in trouble. He's an academic, all-SEC academic guy, and he's on the Student Athlete Advisory Council, so he had kind of built up some goodwill. But he got arrested for a DUI a month before the season started, 2 days before they opened up camp. Can you differentiate between something like this? Boom, automatic, Jim McElwain, you know, suspends a guy for the Michigan game, and Nick Saban doesn't suspend a guy for the Florida State game, an equally important player?
Yes, absolutely. I think everybody who's around the kid, and I'm talking about Saban, McElwain, whoever it is, they know who the good apples are and who the bad apples are. And they know they got to be careful with the bad apples. But this is the situation with Hand is, this is a good kid, and everybody realizes it and recognizes it, and he's going to get a little more leeway. He's going to get the benefit of the doubt. He's going to get a little more rope than the guy who has been a problem year after year and has caused you headache after headache, the guy who just doesn't seem to be able to make right decisions, whether it's on the field or off the field. Go back to Antonio Callaway last year. He looked lost sometimes, you know, running routes and took off field and punt. I mean, he wasn't a guy who looked like he was in control of anything that happened to him.
Mark Long with us from the AP in Gainesville. All right, so where do they go from here? I mean, how big a blow is this for a game that is a very important intersectional game, a game that is not going to impact their ability to get to Atlanta, certainly. But you know, if they're trying to take that next step, Michigan, obviously about a 3.5-point favorite here, and they're trying to make that next step as well. How does this impact this football team on the field? Do they have horses that can cover up the whatever 6-7 catches Antonio Callaway may have had in that game?
They have more horses than they had a year ago. That much is certain. You know, Tyree Cleveland showed some bright spots last year. Freddie Swain is a guy who's looked good this spring, and Josh Hammond also has looked good. They get Dre Massey back, who was going to be this all-everything for them last year, and he blew out his knee and broke a leg, something like that. Got injured in week one and was out for the season. And so they've got enough bodies and a little bit of depth and experience that I don't think it's going to be, you know, a huge setback for them. I think it would have been a much more significant loss last year, but this year they've got some guys. But again, you know, they're going on the road to start the season for the first time since 1987, so this is not a spot that Florida or anybody on this team has really been in. So you're still taking a pretty young team. You're going, you know, to Dallas, this massive, you know, awe-inspiring, jaw-dropping stadium to play Michigan, a team that picked your chief in 2 years ago in the bowl. So, you know, there may be some issues here, but I think more than anything, I think Florida will be okay offensively. And as we know, and we talked about ad nauseum, if Florida can find a quarterback, all those mediocre receivers will all of a sudden look a lot better.
Well, to that end, has he and will he or when will he name the starting quarterback? Has Malik Zaire been named a guy yet or not?
No, it's still wide open. And in fact, there's I think Luke Del Rio has kind of become a dark horse. It's funny because he's a starter last year, started six games, played well at times, and then people wrote him off after, you know, he had two shoulder surgeries in the off season, and people really wrote him off and thought, well, this is going to be Zaire or Frank. And now I think it's a three-man race, and there's no real handicap in this thing. If you would have asked me 2 weeks ago, I would have said Zaire's the guy. But after watching some practice and talking to enough people through the last couple of weeks, I would say Zaire's not a lock, and certainly not even close to being a lock to be an every-down guy. I would not be at all surprised if you see all three of these guys play, or at least two of them, with Zaire being one of the two, play in some sort of rotational.
Gosh, I hate that. I mean, I hate that. I bring back memories of Steve Spurrier running quarterbacks in on every play. That was kind of crazy as well. Mark Long with us, the AP in North Florida. All right, I think, I don't know, from afar now looking at it, to me the biggest disappointment has to be why at age 19 now Felipe Franks hasn't just taken this thing by the bull, you know, this bull by the horns and blown everybody else out of this job, similar to what Jalen Hurts did, who wasn't expected to be that guy, where it just became brutally obvious, regardless of what Blake Barnett or Cooper Bateman think, where it became blatantly obvious that he was the man. Why isn't Felipe Franks the man by now?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question. It's got as much to do with Franks as it does the other guys around him. And Franks just hasn't taken, you know, he's got some leadership ability. He's got all the tools. He's got the big arm. He's 6'5". He's got everything you want, but he just hasn't shown everything on the field. And it's decision-making. It's where to go with the ball. It's some of those things. And it's just kept this competition open to the point where, you know, they brought in Zaire, you know. If he would have been the guy in the spring, they probably don't even go after Zaire.
I'm starting to think, has Kyle Trask transferred to Florida Atlantic yet to play for Lane Kiffin or what? I mean, because he's going to be the guy. He was such a big deal when he came in.
Yeah. Kyle Trask and Josh Allen, both of those guys will probably be looking for new destinations, because especially if they keep this kid from California, supposedly a lock, a five-star quarterback lock who's coming in next year.
All right, before I let you go, we're 3 weeks out. What is your take on that game? I mean, do you think Florida's going to get whacked? You know, Michigan, like you said, kicked their teeth in a couple of years ago. They're now going there without Callaway. Their quarterback situation is going to be in flux, all of that. I've been saying that, you know, Michigan's got a lot of issues too. And, you know, I thought that Florida's defense wouldn't allow Michigan to roll up a lot of points, and I liked Florida in a close game. But do you have – where are you on the game as far as a pick?
Yeah, I mean, the problem is I don't know enough about Michigan. I know they're replacing 17 starters, so they got their hands full. I'll say this. I think Florida will be better offensively, not as good defensively. It'd be crazy to think that they're going to step in defensively after losing the number of guys they've lost the last 2 years. So I think Florida takes a step back defensively, probably takes a step up offensively. Michigan's going to be big physical, and I'll say this. Michigan's probably got the edge coaching. Harbaugh is going to have them ready. They're going to walk in there and be ready for Florida, you know, especially having all this time to prepare for that game. So I think it'll be close. I'll tell you where Florida may win it. Florida's really good on special teams. Very good punter, very good place kicker, and that might be the difference.
Always a pleasure. Mark Long has been our guest from the AP in North Florida. Mark, I appreciate you, man. You know what?
Anytime, Tom. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. So there you go. There's the latest on that deal. When we come back, we'll get the latest on everything else that is going on in the world of sports, including the condition of Gene Stallings, who has suffered another minor stroke. I don't even know what that is. A mini stroke or a minor stroke is a stroke that happens to somebody else, I think. We'll come back with that right after this with T-Mac on 730-1039, the ump. Welcome back, Tom Abraham Show. It's time to get a Doghouse Sports Report with Tony Mack.
After losing two out of three games in the series against the Cardinals, the Atlanta Braves will travel to Colorado to take on the Rockies. Julio Teheran will get the start. You can hear every pitch right here on the Ump. Coverage starts at 7:25. Jared Stidham has officially been named the Auburn starting quarterback. Coach Malzahn, along with the official Auburn Twitter, tweeted the announcement this morning. Stidham started three games as a true freshman at Baylor, where he completed 75 of his 109 passing attempts for 1,265 yards, 12 touchdowns, and two interceptions. The Stidham-led Tigers opened the season with Georgia Southern on September 2nd. Justin Thomas won the PGA Championship this weekend. The Crimson Tide alum shot a 5-under-66 on Friday to get him back into the mix heading into the weekend, where he shot a 69 and a 68 to finish the tournament with an 8-under-276. The PGA Championship is the 24-year-old's first major victory. WWE Hall of Famer Ric Flair has been hospitalized and put in the ICU. Flair, who is 68, has been in the hospital since Saturday, where his reps have pleaded for support. A 30 for 30 about Flair entitled Nature Boy is set to release on November 7th. And Arkansas legend Frank Broyles has passed away from Alzheimer's at the age of 92. Broyles coached the Razorbacks from 1958 to 1976, leading them to a national championship in 64. His 144, 58, and 5 record in 19 seasons are the most wins and games of any Razorbacks coach in their history. College Football Hall of Famer won 7 Southwest Conference titles. I'm Tony Mack, and that is your Doghouse Sports Report.
And former Frank Broyles player David Basil will be joining us at the top of the 5 o'clock hour to talk about Coach Broyles, his impact on college football. And David is the guy who founded the Broyles Award for the Assistant Coach of the Year. So he's been very close to the coach for many, many years. On the Gene Stallings minor stroke, I guess, that he suffered. He was on his way. T-Mac, did you say this? He was on his way to Huntsville when he had this.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I did see. I didn't know he was on his way to Huntsville.
Yeah, he was on his way here for an event tonight. An evening with legendary coaches Pat Dye and Gene Stallings scheduled for tonight here in Huntsville. And then tomorrow night in Montgomery has been postponed, obviously. Pat Dye was the one that confirmed this. And I was like, why is Pat Dye confirming it? And I realized that it was because they were together to speak in Huntsville at this deal tonight. So for those of you that were heading over to see that, an evening with legendary coaches, that's not going to happen. Thoughts and prayers with Coach Stallings, 82 years old. And he was flying out of Dallas-Fort Worth awaiting a flight to Huntsville when he was falling with the mini stroke. So this is the second one. He had that one in May. And we'll see. According to Lynn Huggins, who is Pat Dye's personal assistant, she confirmed that to AL.com that Stallings is stable and communicating. He's resting comfortably. He feels bad about putting everyone out. He feels like he let everyone down. That would be Coach Stallings. That would be pretty much the way that guy would feel. And she said that Stallings is making a point to reschedule the event. He's 82 years old, but he's going to go out of his way to make sure that that thing gets done. So Pat Dye said, we've been friends a long time. We've done speaking things together. We're good friends. He's been active in the state of Alabama. He has as good a name as anyone. I had an opportunity to moderate a breakfast with Gene Stallings and Gene Chizik, a breakfast with the Genes, about 3 years ago, maybe. How long ago was that? It was a fundraiser for the Downtown Rescue Mission in Huntsville. And there was 1,200 people, 1,000 people, something like that at the breakfast. And yeah, and it was a Q&A with the coaches, and I moderated it, and you know, I had the questions and the questions from the crowd. You know, they would give me the questions, and I would ask the questions of the coaches, and we had a pretty good little conversation. But what an honor that was that night, that morning, actually, I should say, to be able to share the stage with Gene Stallings and Gene Chizik. And we actually all rode over to the event in Gene Chizik's SUV. And you know, Chiz is a pretty cool guy, too. I was on that list of people that did not think it was a great hire when they brought Gene Chizik in. But then you get to meet the guy. It's the same thing with Mike Mularkey. I was on the list of people that thought Mike Mularkey was a terrible hire.
You mean Kevin Costner?
Yes, an old Kevin Costner. A taller, older Kevin Costner. It's good call by you. Good doppelganger there. But having said that, after I got to know Mike Mularkey a little bit, then I feel bad for thinking that because he's a good guy. And that's why I'm a sap in this business. I am not the show that you go to get coaches fired. I'm just not that guy. All right, when we return, Jordan Bianchi joins us from SB Nation. We'll talk a little NASCAR with him, Teresa Walker, in the next hour as well. It's the Tom Abraham Show, 7:30, 103.9 AM.
Sports Radio, The Ump, because we care.